Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody. Sorry for that slight delay. My name is McCullough Kozo, and I'll be your host for our weekly Global Awaken Call. Welcome and thank you for joining us. The purpose of these calls is really to share stories and to tell stories, stories that help plant seeds for a more compassionate society while fostering our own inner transformation. We do this by holding collective conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life who inspire us through their actions to live a more service-oriented way. And behind each of these calls is an entire team of service space volunteers whose invisible work allows us to hold this space. Today, our special guest speaker is Shamash Al-Dina, someone who really embodies today's theme of mindfulness and kindness. Thank you again for joining us for today's call. Let's start with a moment of silence to anchor us into the space. Thank you. I let that go for a little longer since today's call is on mindfulness. I figure we might as well do a little extra. Welcome again to our weekly Awaken Call. Today in conversation with Shamash Al-Dina. Here's how the call works. In a few minutes, our moderator, Rahul Brown, will engage in a deep dialogue with our speaker. And by the top of the hour, we'll roll into Q&A in a circle of sharing, where we invite all your reflections and questions. I've opened up the queue right now, so at any point you can hit *6 on your phone, and you'll be prompted when it's your turn to speak. You can also email us at ask@servicespace.org. That's ask@servicespace.org. The theme of today's call is mindfulness and kindness, and I'm very excited about this call because in this day and age, we often hear mindfulness at work, mindfulness in parenting, mindfulness, all this mindfulness, and it's often detached from kindness. And I'm so excited to hear what Shamash is going to share about the necessity of that pairing between mindfulness and kindness. I think mindfulness all by itself can make a really good sharpshooter, for example. But when you pair mindfulness and kindness, I think a lot of powerful inner transformation happens. Today we have the pleasure of a remarkable moderator, Rahul Brown. To give you some context, I'm really excited to have Rahul on this call today, too, because Rahul is somebody who really puts mindfulness at the forefront of everything he does. I've known Rahul for some time now, and I know he's mindful in his parenting. He's mindful in his service. He's mindful at work. In fact, I heard that, Rahul, I don't know if this is still true, but I heard that you have a clause at your work where you get 20 days off a year so you can do 2 10-day Vipassana meditation retreats, and you actually had that written into your contract, and it was something that you laid the law, you laid the line down and said, if I don't get this, I'm not going to work here. So, I mean, that's someone who's really putting mindfulness at the forefront. Thank you, Rahul, for joining us today, and I'll leave it over to you.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Kozo. And yeah, you know, that was true. It was so important to me. And yet when I think about the practice, I really think that there are sort of three stages of exposure and maybe integration along someone's journey with mindfulness. The first is simply like having the causes and conditions to allow one to get exposed to the practice, which I think is huge, right? I mean, there are many people that just don't get the opportunity to even know about this or experience it. I think the second piece is, like, how do you actually put this into practice in terms of systematizing into your life? You know, in other words, committing to it, rather. So creating the space for, you know, time to sit daily, or creating the space in work, in the busyness of work, to allow yourself the space and permission to practice. And then I think the last piece is really the integration, right? As you're pointing out, we hear about this you know, mindfulness everywhere, and it may be a bit of a function of kind of where we are in the world in Silicon Valley, where mindfulness sometimes at its lowest common denominator is viewed as brain hacking, you know, in the tech industry that wants to always figure out how to make things work better and faster and cheaper. But, you know, it really is like the integration is, in my mind, is if you're practicing mindfulness and you don't arrive at this idea of kindness or service at the end of it, then there's something that's really missing. There's a big gap in that integration, and it's become some sort of esoteric practice, which I feel has a tendency to devolve into just plain games, subtle games with yourself. And so, you know, that's sort of why I'm really excited about this conversation with Shamash, because I really feel like he's someone that's sort of integrated this journey and this practice of mindfulness all the way through. So just some background, you know, Shamash is actually a mindfulness pioneer in the UK, and he's the author of Mindfulness for Dummies, which has been an international bestseller. So he's often found sort of coaching, speaking, and practicing the modern relevance and application of this very timeless technique. He's written that spiritual life isn't about avoiding things. Spirituality is about facing up to your challenges with gentleness and kindness. He's also the co-founder of Museum of Happiness, which is a nonprofit organization and also a physical space in London dedicated to creating experiences in the essence of happiness through kindness, community, mindfulness, and creativity. And I think what's perhaps more remarkable is that the space is located in a building for low-income public housing, which creates the possibility for many people who wouldn't otherwise have the opportunity to engage with these practices to have access. You know, personally, I was fortunate to visit the Museum of Happiness a few weeks ago and to meet Shamash, whose energy, I think, certainly embodies happiness and kindfulness, which I think is a term he might have coined. And he does this in a way that's simultaneously very light, but without losing its weight and its gravity. So Shamash, thank you so much for joining us today, especially on short notice.
Thank you very much, Rahul. That's a beautiful introduction. Really appreciate that, and I'm really excited to reconnect with you in this way.
Absolutely. So before we get started, I just wanted to ask you how you're feeling today, and no pressure to answer any particular way.
Oh, that's really nice to ask that. It's actually been quite a busy day for us today. I've been at the Museum of Happiness, which, as you mentioned, is part of actually UK's largest homeless hostel. So it's a place where people who used to be homeless get free housing, and people on low income can get housing. And so we've been training people to teach the skills of mindfulness and kindness and things like that and happiness. And so I've had to kind of come out a bit early, but I'm still in the building, so I'm a bit conscious that there might be some noises and things in the background. So, thanks for asking that. Yeah, so I'm a little bit concerned, and I'm hoping that there won't be too much noise in the background as we have this call. But at the same time, I'm really honored to be here and to have this opportunity to spend a longer time to have conversation with you and to give me time to actually reflect on what kindness and mindfulness and kindfulness means for me, because for me sometimes it comes out in the actual conversation itself. So really, really excited and honored to have this opportunity. So thank you, Rahul, and the team.
Wonderful. And yeah, no worries about noise in the background. It's a pretty forgiving audience, a very kindful audience perhaps. So, you know, I wanted to start off with just a little bit of a understanding of your experience as a mindfulness pioneer in the UK. You know, as I was alluding to in my introduction, in my conversation with Kozo, in Silicon Valley, we live in perhaps a little bit of a bubble, you know, where these two things have come together, and it's more part of the sort of common parlance. You know, we hear about mindfulness yeah. initiatives at the big tech giants, and in a way, it's part of the lexicon. You know, there's proliferation of yoga studios, and there's so much dialogue around mindfulness here and there and all over the place. And I get the sense that the UK, at least from my visit there a few weeks ago, that it very much isn't the same environment, in that it's not something that everyone is talking about. It's not everywhere. And in that way, you really have been a pioneer in bringing awareness of this technique. So I'm just curious about what has been supportive of your efforts at bringing mindfulness into the public sort of domain, the public conversations, and what has also been your experience of the headwinds or the resistance to mindfulness where you've been seeking to teach it?
That's a great question. So I came to the concept, first of all, that concept of the bubble. This is a really, really good question, because I spent some time in Silicon Valley, and yes, I do hear the word mindfulness a lot. But actually, here in London, where I'm based, there is also a lot of news about mindfulness. If you open a newspaper, some of the kind of more left-wing type newspapers, you'll often find an article or something, someone mentioning it. And when I give talks in London, and if I ask if anyone's heard of mindfulness, usually the majority of people have. But I do still think maybe even London is in a bit of a bubble compared to the rest of the UK. And certainly when I've given talks, I remember once I gave a talk to about 100 people in a company in Germany, and not a single hand went up. And it wasn't because they just spoke German. it was, yeah, so I think, and I personally feel I need to be careful as well, because if I'm very much, you know, this is my world and teaching and training and stuff, and it's easy for me to spend other time that are into it as well. So it's hard for me to say exactly how widespread it is and how common it is, but I certainly know that if I went outside of London, or even if I talked to a random person in London, I'm not sure how many people would have actually heard of that concept, first of all. And also, maybe it would be interesting in Silicon Valley, and I know you're saying that, you know, you see it a lot, but sometimes, you know, that concept of, like, for example, if you buy a certain car, suddenly you start seeing that car everywhere. And so that might also be happening for ourselves, because we're living in this world of learning about mindfulness and kindness and compassion. And actually, when you actually find out and ask people, they may have heard of the word or they may not have. And even if they have heard of the word, they may not know what it means. So anyway, in terms of spreading mindfulness here in the UK, I actually didn't come to mindfulness, first of all. I did a Eastern philosophy class where I learned meditation, and it was about cultivating a present moment awareness, but they didn't call it mindfulness at all. But it was I only came to mindfulness because I was, the story in the background is that I was a school teacher teaching in a school called St. James School, where all the children do kind of pause and do meditation. And I'd been teaching there for almost 10 years, and I was looking for an opportunity to spread it more widely rather than just within this small school. And so I looked at research, because I'm interested in science, and I typed in meditation in Google Scholar, and the word mindfulness kept coming up. But I'd actually never heard of it, and it certainly wasn't in the newspapers and the magazines or anything like that. But there was a lot of research on it. I was like, wow, this type of meditation has got so much research, and there's hardly anyone teaching it. So I managed to find a class. And I thought it was a really good, simple way for complete beginners to be exposed to the concept of cultivating a present moment awareness rather than being caught up in past and future, the opportunity to cultivate a sense of stillness and silence and the importance of that, and also through movement practices and through everyday living, like really tasting the food you eat, really listening to the people in front of you, looking after your own health and well-being as well as those around you. So it was a good course. And so then I just did more training and started teaching it in my home. Actually, I was also doing a life coaching course where we did a little visualization about what your ideal life would be. And when I zoomed back into my ideal life, I was teaching meditation in my home, and half of my home was facing the countryside and half was facing the city. And luckily my place was something like that. And so before long, I was teaching these little classes at my house. And in terms of making it more popular here in the UK, the story goes that I was interested in cognitive behavioral therapy. So I was reading books on that, but it wasn't making much sense. And this book, CBT for Dummies, had really good reviews on Amazon. So I started reading that particular book. And I thought it was actually really well written by the two or three therapists. I thought, this is actually a really good series, much better than I thought, and I judged it to be. And then my brother suggested, is there actually a book on mindfulness? And I'm sure there is, but there wasn't. So I just sent a message to them saying, you know, there should be a book to kind of summarize and bring all the teachings of mindfulness together. And then I forgot about it, but one thing led to another. I ended up having meetings with editors and stuff, and eventually I got a phone call saying, we'd like you to write it. So I was like, oh. So that's kind of, and then when that book came out, that was when I think the interest in mindfulness was just starting to grow here in the UK. It's actually, there's been a lot of serious research in the National Health Service, which is the national approach for teaching for the health service here in the United Kingdom. And so there's kind of a research body which looks at the research, specifically UK-based, for recommended treatments, and they were looking for a new treatment for depression, because depression, one in four people get clinical depression in the UK, probably worldwide as well, and it works out to be a very expensive treatment. And at the moment, at that time they were just using antidepressants or talking therapies, which are expensive as well. So they're looking for a lower cost treatment, and so they took a risk and started to research mindfulness. At the time, wasn't that popular in the UK at all, and the clinical trials found it to be many times more effective than the usual treatments, and also much lower cost, especially for people with recurring depression. So that is the recommended treatment, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, it's called. So that was kind of starting to become popular, and this book came out. And so then I decided to, when I kind of looked into my heart, what I really, really wanted to do at that time, and it was to help kind of more people to practice meditation, because that's what I really loved as well. So I decided to do that under the umbrella of mindfulness, as it was a concept which had a lot of research behind it. So yeah, that was back in 2010. And ever since that time, I've been teaching it every day or most days, or training other teachers to be able to teach it. And in the last 3 years, also sharing it through this project we have, which is the Museum of Happiness. And I've written other books since then as well. So I'm so grateful that I've had the opportunity of these different ways of sharing mindfulness and meditation.
That's fantastic. And your answer was so rich. There's so many different directions I can go from what you shared. I definitely want to get to some of the things that you've mentioned about the book, but without jumping ahead too far, I just wanted to dive a little bit into, you know, you shared some of the journey of how you started off with this, sort of at being a teacher at St. James School, but I think there's a bit of a backstory that you were sharing also when I was in London about just your training your scientific training as well, and your experience in sort of finding mindfulness through there. And I think it sounds like even that scientific-based inquiry was a very deep part of how you explored mindfulness. So I'm wondering if you can share that color and context of sort of how the journey at the personal level really deepened for you, and maybe what the struggle was at the personal level that led to it.
Great question. Sure, sure. So I'll kind of mix in the concept of science and that. That's a beautiful question. So in terms of science, like when I say the word science, some people, I can notice in their eyes, they get switched on and some people kind of get switched off. So it can be quite a polarizing thing. But I know for me personally, as a young child, I had these small ladybird books and about batteries and bulbs and magnets. And I just loved, as a young child, doing scientific experiments and chemistry experiments in the garden and playing with magnifying glasses and setting things on fire and burning my hand and things like that. So really, really having a lot of fun with science and making robots out of cardboard boxes and all sorts. I wasn't any kind of massive genius, but I just really loved playing and doing things in a scientific way. And then I remember being at school and doing kind of exams and not being that difficult, and me ended up being, you know, maybe top of the class or quite high up in the class. So I thought, oh, wow. I'm doing, like, this is something that I'm actually good at, and it doesn't even take that much effort. So I thought, this is fantastic. Like, my parents were praising me, and the teachers were praising me, and I was just being myself. I was just doing my thing, and people seemed to be happy about that. So I had this very positive association with science, and it made a lot of sense to me as well. It seemed to be like with science, you could have an equation, and it had one answer, and it's either right or there's some logic, and it's wrong. So it made a lot of sense to me, whereas something like English or, you know, drama or these kind of arty subjects, there was no right or wrong. It was very much more subjective, whether the teacher liked it or not. That's how I felt anyway. So I liked science maths for that reason. And as I said, I had this positive relationship to it, and it gave me a sense of self-esteem, I actually discovered later on. And if I did well, it boosted my self-esteem, and if I did badly, it kind of lowered my self-esteem. So I discovered that, you know, this, and because I was doing well when I was at school and initially at college, my confidence was linked to that, and I was doing well. So the story is that I had this idea in my head that, you know, I would become like a doctor or an engineer or some sort of scientist, and I'd be very successful, and although I didn't go through this thought process, I was probably thinking, you know, I'll be very successful, I'll be making a lot of money, and that will make me very happy. And I didn't think of that consciously. It was like an unconscious thing. You almost breathe in through, you know, the culture that I grew up in anyway. So it was just the thing to do, absolutely. So I remember going to the careers advisor and saying, you know, I'm thinking about becoming a doctor. Like, you know, I know my parents would be really proud of it in Asian cultures. If you're a doctor, that's it. You're almost like God. So I was thinking, I'm thinking of being a doctor. And I remember the careers advisor saying, did you know that doctors have one of the highest suicide rates of all careers? I'm like, really? Oh, I didn't know that. Okay, so what's the next thing on the list which has a lot of income involved and money involved? And it was chemical engineering. I'm like, oh, wow, yeah, I'll be earning a lot of money if I do that. So I looked that up and I thought, okay, sign up for that. So I didn't have any kind of reflection about what would be purposeful or meaningful. That concept didn't come up at all. I didn't think about that. And so I went off to this university. And as I'd said to you before, my self-esteem was connected to my grades and how successful I was compared to others on this unconscious level. And when I went to university, it's quite a good university for UK, it's called Imperial. So you get these people coming from all over the world, and suddenly it's much more competitive. And what was easy for me to be top of the class of was much harder. And I just about managed to do it in the first year, and in the second year, I wasn't so good, actually. It was harder for me, and maybe it was less effort for someone else, but for me, it was much harder. So I thought, okay, that's okay, because, you know, I'm going to have this amazing job and make all this money and then be happy. And then I remember doing the job in the summer vacation where I tried it, chemical engineering, and I suddenly realized that this was probably the most boring experience of my six weeks of my life. I was going in, sitting on this desk, and they wanted me to design an oil rig in Indonesia, sitting in an office in London, and it was the same people I saw every day. And I suddenly realized, I don't want to create more oil rigs in the world. I want to do something else. I didn't know what, but I knew it didn't feel right. But in the back of my mind, I was getting paid, and this money was going into my bank account. And then I know it sounds a bit strange, but I remember going to Oxford Street in London to be able to buy some clothes, which I thought would... Again, unconsciously, thought it would make me happy. But I remember buying these clothes with all this money that I had in this bank account and almost no positive feeling coming out of it, just for a few moments. And I remember standing in Oxford Street and seeing all these... It's quite interesting that was the location, which is the heart of the commercial retail world in London, or maybe even in Europe, with people buying stuff everywhere. And actually feeling a real sense of loss of, of meaning in my life. I didn't know. I'm like, this is suddenly the penny dropped, like literally the penny dropped, in the sense that I'd spent this money and the feeling that I was hoping to get, that sense of well-being, was not there at all. And I thought, what? Everyone's been telling me that money will bring happiness and joy and this is what it's all about. But actually, I really hated this work, and the feelings I was expecting I was not getting. And so I was like a 19-year-old student, 20-year-old student, something like that, and I didn't know what to do. So I was at a loss. And although I'm explaining it all now, at the time, it was almost like it's happening to a child. So there wasn't this conscious process of like, okay, so money doesn't make me happy, so I need to do this. There's no logical thinking, because I suppose I was at a low level of mindfulness, and it wasn't me doing life with making choices. It was just happening to me, just like it does to a child, I suppose. This is something I'm realizing as I'm talking to you, actually. So anyway, I was on the underground, the London Underground, the tube, as they call it, and I saw a poster for a philosophy class, and it was a quotation, I think maybe from Socrates or someone, like, the unexamined life is not worth living. I thought, that sounds really good, actually. And this practical philosophy class sounded like the complete opposite of a master's in chemical engineering. And it was cheap. It was like £20 for students. I thought I'd go along to this class and I might learn something. And quite fortunately, in my case, this philosophy class was an excellent student. I think I still remember that first class, because it wasn't necessarily all philosophies, but kind of lent towards Eastern philosophies. And they started using the words consciousness. Now, I'm very used to that word now, and it's very familiar to me. But if you take someone, the average person from the scientific world, or any average person or young person, you wouldn't normally be exposed to that word, the concept of awareness or consciousness. And they had this beautiful diagram where they wrote kind of deep sleep as the lowest level of consciousness, and dreaming sleep as a little bit higher, and then your normal waking consciousness, which is almost like, if you go on the underground in London, it's like a half awake, half asleep state. I'm not sure. Maybe it's a dream state, because people are living automatically. But then they said, what if there is a concept of a higher level of consciousness or a higher level of awareness? And if you cultivate this high level of awareness, through doing exercises which have been developed in the Eastern world for thousands of years, maybe more, if you try cultivating, you cultivate higher levels of awareness and you live life more fully. Because if low levels of awareness, you're kind of half asleep or dreamy, then very high levels of awareness means that you live life more in the moment and more in the here and now, and experience life in a more full way. And so my logical brain at the time says, yeah, that actually does make complete sense. And then they did an exercise where they got us to just become aware of our the colors around us, and then asked us to close our eyes and go through each of our senses, sense of touch, sense of smell, the sense of sound, and then also that sense of silence, and also helping us to actually step back from our thoughts. So your thoughts are popping up just like clouds in the sky, but you're the observer. You're the witness. There's a space between you and those thoughts. You don't have to do what those thoughts say. You are not exactly what those thoughts tell you. You are not your thoughts. You're just the observer of it. In fact, you're an observer of all those experiences. And then we came out of that little 5-4 minute exercise, and I'm so grateful in that was like a life light bulb moment, almost literally, in that I thought, wow, just this small exercise, and I feel so different. I didn't know that I was in a negative emotional or mental state, but I did know that I felt more refreshed and more calm and more in the moment. And then they started to say that actually the purpose of life is not about, you know, you get a job and then you're happy, or you get married then you're happy, or you get children then you're happy, or you get grandchildren and then you're happy, or you live in this place. Actually, did you know that that sense of fulfillment and well-being can be just in having a conversation on the phone like we are now, or it could be just looking at the clouds in the sky or the trees around you? This, again, maybe it's very, very normal for the listeners that are listening today, but for me, this was groundbreaking. I'm like, what, you mean you don't need to constantly have these goals that you need to achieve? You can just be happy. Like at the moment, I'm sitting on a staircase. It's like a fire escape staircase, and having a conversation with you. And you can actually be content there where you are right now. So I actually got so excited about this concept that I started to read every single book that's out there on you know, the from The Power of Now to Who Am I and Ramana Maharshi and Krishnamurti and almost every kind of book on that subject. I was so fascinated. And actually, I've written a blog post about this recently because I almost went too far in that I stopped going to university in my third year, stopped studying. When I was driving, wow. I was almost getting so conscious and so much in the moment that I actually didn't know where I was going. Wow. I remember driving in completely the wrong direction and not being able to judge distances properly. So I almost took it to an extreme at the beginning because I was so excited about it. It was just a totally, it's like... it's different to, like, you know, when you have a computer and you change the operating system. It wasn't like that. It was like something completely different. I don't know what the analogy would be. Maybe from a normal phone to a smartphone, or maybe from no phone to a phone itself. It was like being a having a completely different life. A life before where everything is about goals and about achievement and getting somewhere, and that's what the life is all about, and living very much on automatic pilot, to actually, there's a completely different way of living where actually you can find fulfillment in the now. So I was so excited about this. I wanted to teach every single person, and that's why I struggled to even go to university, but I managed to finish my engineering degree. But I knew that, okay, I need to teach every child this, because I'm like, I can't believe I had to wait till I was so old, 20 years old, before I learned stuff about meditation. And I wish I'd learned this earlier. And so I wanted to share it with the younger people, so that's why I decided to actually become a science teacher, but a teacher in a school where all the children do this, where they pause between lessons, where they learn about these kind of Eastern philosophies and Western philosophies, where they have time to reflect on what's the meaning and purpose in life, and yeah, all these other kind of aspects which go along with this field.
Sure.
It was a real sense of meaning and purpose that I found through these practices.
Absolutely. I was going to ask how parentals responded to you finding that sense of meaning and purpose, especially when it was contrasted to letting go of the goals, the achievements, and perhaps the bank account.
Well, how my parents reacted is what you said.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were not too bad, actually. I mean, they were really expecting me to obviously become a doctor. They thought, okay, engineer will do. And then I didn't do engineering, but I did straight away start studying to become a teacher, and they thought that was very strange. But they kind of went along with it. And then I think they accepted it, and ultimately they've become really, really proud of what I do. And I can hear them when they speak to others. In particular, you're like, they don't say it often to my face, but I can hear it when they talk to other people. Like, you know, my son is doing meditation, he's doing mindfulness, and he's written these books and stuff. So yeah, I'm really unfortunate that they're proud of what I've done. But they were very, very skeptical at the beginning. But I'm really fortunate in that they weren't too harsh on me at all. They just they're just a bit curious about what is he up to. Right. I'm still not 100% convinced, but I think they're much more convinced than they were at the beginning.
Yeah, I can see why. So it was interesting. You were talking about, you know, the sort of upset at having to wait till you're 20 to experience mindfulness. But it wasn't long after that you actually ended up writing the book, if I'm following the chronology correctly. So I'm just curious, like, what you shared a little bit about the synchronicity of what was happening on the national stage around research related to depression, et cetera. Yeah. But I'm curious about what changed for you kind of before and after writing that book in terms of your work and your approach.
Interesting. So in terms of, I first learned meditation when I was age 20, and I wrote the book when I was age, 33. So it was quite a big, big, it was like 13 years of me practicing and teaching meditation and stuff. So before and after writing the book. So although I went to the school and became a teacher, and I became very interested in cultivating teaching meditation, I think even that became a little bit automatic, in that schools are very much based on routines, and you know, start at a certain time, 8:30, you finish at 4:30, and you've got these books that you need to mark, and there's lessons you need to teach. So it's almost like the 9 to 5 that other people do. I almost, perhaps I started getting caught up in that too. And it was after being a school teacher for about 6 or 7 years, and gradually more and more of my hair was falling out, and eventually all my hair fell out. And I thought, what's going to fall off next? I'm just kind of joking there. But it did have its stresses and its challenges, certainly. Training to become a school teacher was one of the hardest things I've ever done, and I was very close to giving up on doing that and changing it to doing another job. So it had its stresses and challenges. But it went from being a stressful and challenging thing to becoming just about right, to becoming easy, and then eventually becoming too easy, in the sense that, okay, I'm just teaching the same class again. I know what I need to do, and I knew what to set the class, and it became mechanical. And then I got concerned, like, teaching is all about being really passionate about the subject and sharing that passion with the students. And if I start to lose that passion, it's not really fair for the students that I'm like that. And I saw the teachers that had been working there for 20, 30, 40 years, and some of them did have that passion, and then some of them actually, they'd completely lost that passion and were just coming and teaching in the school in a very mechanical way, just to make the money, just to make sure that they, you know, their family and stuff are all right, which is understandable. But they weren't really there. It wasn't so meaningful. I could see it in their eyes and their behavior. And I was concerned that that would start happening to me. So that was one of the things. The other thing was that I learned about this concept of coaching, which was quite new to me at the time. And I was experimenting with coaching students. So when you're teaching a class of 25 or 30 teenage students, you don't really have much time to kind of connect to them on a one-to-one basis. And everything's done in the sense of groups and group dynamics. But I'd read and researched about coaching. So rather than telling children what to do, I made it my kind of business in my free time to actually sit down with the students and actually ask them questions like, what do you most enjoy? Which lessons do you not enjoy? What do you think you're really good at? What's the one thing that you need to work on this week? And really using the training that I did on coaching to actually coach students through the process. And that felt so good. I wanted to do more and more of that, but there wasn't. The head teacher couldn't make time for me to do that. So that was one thing. But what was really interesting, and I mentioned it in passing, in that I did this because I was training in coaching as well. I'd actually done this visualization of what my ideal life would be like. And so in this visualization, I imagine I went out into space, is what the coach told us to do. And when you go back, you come back to your ideal lifestyle. And it was only when I'd done that I realized actually teaching children in school, science, plus a little bit of mindfulness, is not really 100% in tune with what my heart really wants to do. What my heart really wants to do is to be sharing this meditation and cultivating inner stillness all the time, as much as I can. So I wanted to make it much more part of my life. And that's a bit scary, isn't it? Because if you've got this kind of, well, it was for me anyway, that I've got this kind of life, and I've got this job, and I'm settled in, and I've got this income that I've got, and this particular lifestyle, and yet my ideal, what I really want to do in my heart, was not quite in line with that. But when I don't do things that are in line with what's really important to me, it's really, really difficult for me. So I knew I had to make those changes. So I started taking those steps. And that's something that's, I suppose, that's one of my strengths. Like, if I do, I want to do something, I start taking small steps in that direction and see what happens. So I did do that. So for a little while, I had to change to a different school. So I wasn't working 5 days a week. In fact, the funny story is that I wanted to get a job. I asked the head teacher, can I work 4 days a week here? And he said, no, sorry, you have to work full 5 days a week. So then I looked in the newspaper, and there's a job for a physics teacher, which is what I was mainly, 4 days a week. And there's a school which is literally across the road. So I just crossed the road, wow, did the interview, and I managed to get the job. And so I worked there for the 4 days a week and spent that one free day starting to do more training in mindfulness and teaching more adults meditation and mindfulness. And the book thing was actually not in my plans. It happened very naturally. I described the story briefly to you. I literally went to the website dummies.com and I just clicked on contact and just sent them a very short message. So it's something that was kind of almost meant to be, I think. They'd actually asked what he's called the father of mindfulness, I think John Kabat-Zinn, a year before, and he'd said no, and somebody else had said no for whatever reason. And so they'd left the project. And so then when I did it, when I approached them, just one thing led to another. And I think another little story I'd like to share about writing, which was really challenging for me, is that at first I thought, I'm not good enough to write this book. Why am I writing this book? So these kind of thoughts kept coming. And I did use, you know, my mindfulness and practice to say, actually, no, it seems like I am the person who has been chosen to write this. So, you know, maybe that's just a limiting belief. So I had to keep practicing letting that go. But then the real challenge was actually to write the book, because I remember I had to write the first chapter, What is Mindfulness? So I looked in one book and it had a definition, another book had a different one, another one. And I bought about 20 different books on mindfulness and they all had a different definition of what mindfulness was. So I remember spending a whole week trying to write the first paragraph and really struggling. And so then I had this idea, why not read a book called How to Write a Book. So I did that. Yeah. And I realized that actually I wasn't being mindful or kindful in my actual writing. I wasn't trusting myself. I was trying to write the perfect sentence and the perfect paragraph. I was being judgmental of myself. And in this book, it talked about just writing a flow of consciousness, just writing down whatever comes to your head and just keep writing and don't edit it. Keep writing, writing, writing. And like I told you earlier, I'm much more of a scientist than, you know, a writer at that time, especially. So it was difficult for me. But then I started this process of not being judgmental to myself, which is what mindfulness is about, just letting it flow. And it went from being a really difficult process to actually almost call it a spiritual experience, or this process where I wasn't part of it and it was just coming from me. Then those moments were really magical and I really, really enjoyed that. And it made the actual process enjoyable. And it wasn't like that all the way through, I need to be honest with you, because they didn't even give that much time, just a few months to write it as well. And I was teaching at the same time too. So it was a challenging time, but finding the sense of flow and letting go of the inner judgments was a real breakthrough for me. And I enjoy writing a lot more now through that. So it was about practicing the mindfulness as I wrote it. So yeah, so that's that little story of kind of what happened before and after.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. What would you say to someone who comes to you and says, look, I don't know how to listen to my heart. How do I start to hear where I'm truly feeling called?
No, that's really good. So I would probably say to that person, I think every person's different, so it's not like I would give a standard answer. But I think today, let's say if you asked me that, I would probably ask you questions like, okay, what do you like to do? I'll just start with where people are, like, and start asking them what they enjoy doing. And then from there, kind of tease out what the answer is. But with these kinds of questions, I think it's what's really important is to be really present to the person and the question they're asking, because if people ask the question, you know, what should I do? What should I do with my life? But it can be in a very different way. It could be like, yeah, what do you think I should do with my life? Or what do you think? You know, the tone of voice, the way they say it, the state of mind they're in, this would all influence, I think, my response at that time. Probably my state of mind would affect that too. But I'd probably start with finding out what they do enjoy doing. And if they say, I don't actually enjoy anything at the moment. I hate my job. I hate my husband or wife, or I hate my family, and everything's negative. Then just ask them to reflect on what they enjoyed when they were young. I like to share the story, actually. This is a nice story. Someone I met at a festival called Into the Wild. So this festival I was at, there was there's lots of chai being served, although it's in England. For some reason, there's different people serving chai. And there's this one particular place that was serving chai. It was really delicious. And there's this elderly gentleman with this big beard. And I just started to get into a conversation because he looked really interesting. I'm like, this is the fantastic chai that you've made. It's really, really good. He's like, yeah, this is the best chai. And then he started talking about India. He said, I actually haven't shared this with many people, but this is my story. And his story was that he was actually the son of a prostitute, and he went through a very difficult childhood, but he had kind of foster parents that brought him up. And when he was young, they used to get to do some gardening. He used to kind of enjoy that, actually, as a young child, and did some gardening and spending time in the garden and cutting the grass and having different plants and putting it together. So this was kind of soothing for him, and he grew up and left these parents. And then he ended up going to having a partner, a girlfriend. It didn't work out, so he went off to India. He was living in a cave in India and with some other people. And I think it was in Dharamsala, so near where the Dalai Lama is. And somebody was serving food and stuff, and they gave this other small thing, which he thought was just food, but actually it was opium. And what this chap was doing, this Indian guy, he was getting people addicted to opium. So then he got addicted to opium, then he ended up getting addicted to heroin and becoming a heroin addict, both in India and in the UK and in London. Then he started becoming a drug dealer as well to feed his habit, and he became more and more successful as a drug addict and making lots of money, almost becoming famous for it, and very close to getting into prison, and he's got all sorts of stories about that. But he ended up being this extreme drug addict, and I think he was on heroin for at least 11 years. So injecting himself with heroin, can you imagine? And so eventually ended up being in a gutter in London shooting this heroin, and someone managed to convince him to go to a homeless hostel, a different one to this one. So he went to this homeless hostel, and he just was kind of looking outside, and he saw there was a few pot plants outside or a small garden. And then suddenly he had this memory of a child, of when he was a child and he used to do the gardening. I think he might have asked himself the question, you know, what did I really used to enjoy? I can't remember the exact question he asked himself, or if it was just seeing those pot plants. But anyway, he stepped outside, started doing some gardening, and then his friends, who were also addicted to drugs, got them to start doing a little bit of gardening and planting different plants. And he described his stories how people would do a little bit of gardening with him, then go off to steal something, then get some drugs, then come back and do a bit more gardening. So there's a bit of a triangle going on. But the gardening people found soothing, and he found soothing, so much so that he managed to quit taking drugs. And he really enjoyed empowering others. So then he started to help other people to get off drugs. Then these gardens became more and more successful, and he's actually ended up doing the roof garden in one of the famous areas in London called the South Bank Centre. He's also participated in the Chelsea Flower Show, one of the most famous garden shows in the world, and won a prize there, and is with one of the cheapest gardens they've ever had. So he actually managed to somehow tune into his heart and find out what he used to love, what he used to enjoy. And you can't really force that. It kind of seems to have just happened in that moment. Somebody was kind to him, got him to a place where he could rest a little bit, and it might have been just a quiet moment or something clicked in his head, and suddenly he decided. And now he's actually very poor still. He told me, "I'm very poor, Shamash, and I'm very, very happy." And he's had lots of money in his time as well as all the drugs. But he helps and supports so many people, and it makes him feel so good. So this is just an example of, not a direct answer to your question, but a nice example of when you can somehow have the memory or thought of what I used to enjoy when I was a child. I think almost all of us had some things that we really liked and really enjoyed. And then maybe just starting somewhere like that and going from there, just taking just a few quiet moments of reflection, and something could come up.
Well, that's a remarkable story.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
That story, that was just a beautiful story.
Thank you.
So Shamash, I wanted to, I know that maybe in about 7 or 8 minutes, we're going to open things up for folks on the call to sort of ask you questions, and there's so much ground I feel like we haven't covered, so I'll try and ask a two-for-one question. The Museum of Happiness is, I described a little bit about it, but one of the things that's also remarkable about it is it's a gifted space where it really feels like a gift economy experiment. And so I'm very curious about how you think about and walk with this question of money and financial stability, both in regards to the Museum of Happiness and also with regard to this work around giving the priceless teachings to people, especially people who need them the most. And feel free to tell us more about Museum of Happiness in the answer as well.
Sure, sure. So I'll just briefly share the story of the Museum of Happiness. It came through a coincidental meeting with someone who's at a charity event. We were both trying to eat the same carrot. We both went to grab the same carrot. And then we just became friends. And she ended up doing some mindfulness classes with me, a girl called Vicky. And we just wanted to spread the concepts of mindfulness and stillness and other values like kindness and sense of creativity and playfulness is, we feel, is very important and sometimes missing in both spirituality as well as in the workplace and all sorts of different areas. It's really, really important to have this sense of creativity and fun and playfulness, I believe, even in the most so-called inverted commas serious of meditation practitioners or people that want to cultivate stillness. I think if there's not that sense of lightheartedness and playfulness, then something's missing. So we wanted to bring all that together, and so we had absolutely no idea how to do that. So we just started doing very small events with handfuls of people. And what happened is that we got, you know, 20 people together, 30 people, 40 people. And I think I'd actually been to some service space. I'd heard some talks by Nipun Mehta. I'd heard some stuff about service space. I was relatively new to it, but I'd heard some things about it. And so we were trying to bring, you know, cultivate that sense of generosity and kindness, and as well as the fun and the playfulness and the meditation, and bringing it all together. And we did all these different classes and things. And one year, towards the end of that year, I think it was maybe 2 years ago, just before New Year's Eve, I was on holiday and I remembered that we wanted to do an event in a market, a famous market in East London called Spitalfields Market. And we wanted to try and get 100 people. We had 2 weeks to share the event, and we wanted people, so we called it the world's first pop-up Museum of Happiness, and we wanted to create a space for people to explore the art and science of happiness, to learn about what does it mean to be kind and compassionate, what does it mean to be mindful or peaceful, what does it mean to have that sense of creativity and playfulness, what does community mean, how do we, what's the science, is there a science behind happiness, and what is that? So we came up with that idea, and we just had this description. I put it on Facebook like I normally did, and we were hoping to get, you know, a handful of registrations. And somehow something sparked in our little community of 50 or 60 people that had come to our 3 or 4 events. I think because of our heart was really into it, we were just doing it for because we loved it so much, these little events that we did. And so they shared it with their friends, and they shared it with their friends. And when I kind of tuned back in, a million people had seen the Facebook page, and
wow,
tickets had gone to 10,000 people, and then that was the limit for the tickets, and so it couldn't go any higher than that, luckily. So I was trying to contact my friend on New Year's Eve, but she was obviously busy somewhere, saying that we've got 10,000 people, we normally have 100, I don't know how we're going to cope with this. We got together and we decided we would try and pull this off. And so I suppose we did use this abundance mindset because the tickets were just free or donation-based. And I thought, okay, this London, it was actually, the actual day of the event is supposed to be the most depressing day of the year in London. It's called Blue Monday, which is the third Monday in January. So just when you get the bills from the Christmas events, and, you know, just when you realize that Valentine's Day is coming up and you're not too sure who you're going to go and spend that evening with. And so it's very cold and very dark in London at that time. So it's quite a tough time for most people. So we decided to do it on that day. So maybe that was part of its popularity. Anyway, a lot of people came and there's a lot of media interest. And so we thought this, you know, this idea has something that people are really passionate about. So what happened is that one lady came along and she runs what is called the Canvas Cafe in East London. And she's like, I've got some space in the back of my cafe. You can actually go from just doing these pop-up things to creating a permanent home for the Museum of Happiness. And it was not a huge amount of rent, so it was kind of affordable, very certainly affordable. And because we'd been inspired by the philosophy of service space, we thought, why don't we try and do it through as an act of kindness and based on generosity. So a pay it forward approach. So we gift the space and we ask the teachers to gift their time if they're willing to do so, and then invite people to either pay it forward for the next class. But we did we didn't do it quite as pay it forward. We did it more of a gift philosophy. So we said, you know, maybe give a friend a hug, or maybe do something nice for the teacher, or maybe just say thank you to someone, or just smile a little bit more. So it's just about sending these ripples of positivity. So it didn't have to be financial at all. And we weren't, or I wasn't too concerned about the finance side of things at that time, because if it was affordable. So, yeah, so that's the experiment that we did, and it created such a beautiful community. Another little story, an example of what happened, is that the cafe owner also had pay it forward coffees and teas and even meals, so you could buy an extra meal for someone. And so there's a guy who was homeless who came along into the cafe, and he got a coffee, and then he wandered around to the back, and he saw that we were doing a meditation class at this place called the Museum of Happiness. So he was shivering and cold, so he came in. And Vicky, who was guiding the meditation, she's like, oh, welcome, please sit down. And since he was shivering, some of the students said, oh, take my coat or take my blanket, and that helped to warm him up. And then Vicky did a guided meditation, which was like a beach meditation. So they imagined the warmth on your feet and on your legs and on your belly and your back. And because of this beautiful warm visualization, he started to feel warmer physically too. And he started to really warm up and really smile and participated in the other bits of meditation they did. And then he actually shared that just 2 weeks earlier, he was seriously suicidal, and he just felt that he could not connect with anyone in London. And those 2 weeks since then had been really, really tough for him. And he kept coming to so many classes over the next few weeks, all the different classes that we had in the evenings. He came along, and whether it was things like yoga or art, mindful art, things like that. And so he really got this sense of community from that space. And I think this wouldn't have happened if we hadn't had this approach of, you know, welcoming people or having this kind of donation-based approach in that place. So some really nice stories like that came up, which kind of inspired us and motivated us to kind of keep going. So that's where we are. But now, to be honest, it is more challenging because if we're in a place which is much more expensive, and there's some salaries that we need to pay for as well. But we're still thinking of trying to do that as much as possible. And between you and me, we haven't announced this publicly, but we're looking forward to doing Awaken Circles at the Museum of Happiness, which will be obviously gifted and complete philosophy of the Awaken Circles that Service Space has. We also have started a Kind Club, which is also a gifted experience where people come along and we explain the philosophy of Pay It Forward. And they make a gift, and they give that gift, either it could be to people in the local area who are homeless, or to a friend or a neighbor or someone. And you make this gift, you know, you put books in and you put positive messages in, and you make this nice box together, and you spend some time creating a card, which you kind of color in as well, so you get your creative juices flowing. And this links with our values in building community, doing creativity, an act of kindness. And also there's a sense of mindfulness and presence. So these are... we will always have these different kind of elements of generosity and kindness. And we may actually expand that experiment even more so. So almost everything has that philosophy, and see how it goes. I'm very much in the lines of Service Space and trying different things and pushing the boundaries as an experiment. And let's just see if it works. And also learn from the experience of other people who have done it to make sure that we have the best chance of it being successful. So it's really, really exciting, and it creates a real sense of warmth and community when we do that. And it's worked so well in the past that we want to continue to do that and continue to push our own kind of comfort boundaries of generosity and try and expand it more and more, because that feels so good.
Beautiful. I know that we're at the top of the hour here, which is when I typically pause for Kozo to send an announcement out. Kozo, do you want to step in for a moment?
Yeah. I let the time pass. I was supposed to chime in, I think, at 10 till the top of the hour, but I was just listening to the stories and I forgot. So we were going to open it up to a circle of sharing and Q&A. If you'd like to join by phone, you can hit *6 on your phone and you'll be placed into the queue. Or you can send an email to us at ask@servicespace.org. That's ask@servicespace.org. We already have a number of reflections and questions in the from the email. But I wanted to, ask a question, Shamash, and it's related to something that we posted on the page for you, the prompt. And it says, our guest speaker this week notes that for some people, mindfulness or spirituality can be used as a way of avoiding daily responsibilities or to repress feelings, and said that mindfulness instead should be used to, quote, lean into life, to face up to your challenges, and to move towards emotional difficulties we all share with kindness, end quote. And I find that a very powerful distinction, using mindfulness as perhaps an escape as opposed to using mindfulness to lean into and to go into difficult emotional areas. And the two obvious things that come up for me is, the Buddha and Jesus, right? So the Buddha, supposedly on the night of his awakening, had to deal with temptation and, I forget the name of the God that sent him these different challenges. And then, of course, Jesus, when he went out into the woods 40 days and 40 nights, he had to deal with what they call the devil tempting him with fame, fortune, and all these different things. And they sat through that mindfully and aware. And I'm wondering if you have either any personal stories or any stories of people who you coach or people who you've taught of leaning into those difficult emotions and those challenges, and how that process plays out. Because it's one thing to say to lean into difficult emotions mindfully, but it's another thing to practice it, right? It can be a very difficult practice. So just any stories or reflections on that?
Sure. Well, that's such a beautiful question. You guys ask such great questions. The example that comes to mind is something that someone shared today in our training, and it was about anger, actually. And it's my friend, and she was a very, very angry child and very, very angry through her teenage years. And people used to say to her things like, if you feel angry, I think it's a Nepalese saying, if you feel angry, put it in your feet. And she's like, how do I put anger in my feet? I mean, how do I do that? Nobody explained to her how to kind of cope with her anger. She's like, what do I shout underneath my feet? And so she constantly slamming doors and being annoyed and, always very righteous. And she also gave this example of, like, although she was a smoker herself, there was a no smoking sign that came up on the trains in her country. And she used to actually see people leaning on the no smoking sign and start smoking. And she started smoking with her anger in terms of her anger. And she had, like, shall I tell this person what to do? Even though she used to smoke herself. So there's always people that were doing unjust things and things that were not right. And that made her really, really angry. But she had a very, very wise grandma. And her grandma explained to her that her true nature is, I think, what it's called in Sanskrit, Satchit Ananda. Truth, consciousness, and bliss. This was actually what her true nature was. And something clicked in that. But still, something wasn't quite right there. She didn't know what to do with that anger. And another time, my grandma told her, if you feel angry, it doesn't mean you have to act angry. And she was like, really? She's like, yeah, just because you feel angry doesn't mean you need to shout or get angry or swear or run around. You can just observe it. You can just be the observer, the witness. And she said, ah. And so she actually just did that. So I think it was just a decision that she made because she knew she had to do something. And the next time anger came up, she was so angry. The only way she could stop from being angry was to start drinking water to cool it down. So she used to go and just drink glasses of water or walk in the other room or clench her teeth and try and stroll around and to observe it. And then someone told her that actually anger is a physical feeling in your body. So she could arch it. So then she started noticing that anger actually started in her stomach. So she started to watch that and become curious about that. And she continued to do this until eventually I would never have guessed this about her. She's such a kind of a calm, positive, smiley person. She's at work, they call her the happiness guru. So you can tell how much she's changed and transformed. Such a beautiful example of how we can transform our so-called destructive emotions through the practice of mindfulness. But there's another example which I'd like to share, which has been a really powerful story that I heard, which is from my teacher, who's called Ajahn Brahm, who first told me about this concept of mindfulness. And it was a lady, it was a student at university, and she was suffering from so much anxiety, she was trapped in her own room in the halls in the residence in the university. She had extreme amounts of anxiety about exams, about everything. And psychologists had tried to help her, and she was on all the different medication, and she was sometimes even on oxygen in hospital, and she just couldn't get out of it. But she was from original Thai descent, so she decided to call up this Thai monk. So they have a Dalai monk service almost. So she called him up, and he's a very busy guy, but a very busy monk. But he said, okay, where do you feel this anxiety? And she's like, I don't know, I feel it in my body somewhere. He's like, I'm going to call you in 2 days' time. Tell me exactly where it is. So she observed it in her body. She found out that it was in her chest. So the next time he called, she said, oh yeah, I've got the anxiety in my chest. He's like, what's the shape of it and where exactly is it? She's like, well, I don't know. So this kind of kept happening. He kept calling back every day or two until eventually she knew exactly the shape and size and texture and location and the temperature of this sensation of anxiety. So this is a beautiful example of mindfulness, becoming mindful of the emotion. So then he said, okay, what I want you to do now is I want you to be kind to this emotion. I want you to rub it with your hand. I want your boyfriend to rub it, and he was very happy to rub her belly or whatever to soothe soothe this emotion, and to just be really friendly and kind to it. And then eventually the calls went back and forth, and it disappeared. Some days it actually disappeared. And so then the monk asked this beautiful question, this key question: when the physical sensation of the anxiety disappears, what happens to the anxiety? And then she went quiet for like 30 seconds and her mind started ticking. He's like, oh, the anxiety disappears completely when the physical sensation. He said, exactly. This is what you need to do. Cultivate mindfulness and kindness. And the beautiful end of the story is that she ended up finishing her degree, passing it. She ended up getting married to this boyfriend of hers, and the monk actually married the two together, and now they've got a child as well. So it's actually life-changing, it's life-saving, the mindfulness and the kindness. And yes, it is really difficult, Koza, like you say, really, really hard, but there's no other option sometimes. It's like we're against the wall. We've got this challenging emotion or challenging difficulty or challenging situation in our life, and there's no other option apart from becoming aware of it, and not just being aware, which is why I keep emphasizing the kindfulness. The kindness and the compassion, the love, is the element that heals, and we need the mindfulness at the beginning to actually become aware of it in the first place. And so she was fortunate in that she had that teacher to guide her through that process. But it's actually very, very simple, and I do believe that ultimately life and the challenges can be faced in a simple way, not always easy, but certainly simple. And I'm sure you've got personal examples of this too, of meeting these challenges with the awareness and the kindness, and probably the most healing thing that I've experienced in the world.
Wow. Yeah, and thank you so much, because that kind of, I started off excited about this conversation because of the combination of mindfulness and kindness, and for you to give us that, you know, concrete example of how that mindfulness and kindness heals. That's beautiful. It reminds me of, you know, a lot of times when you do the meditation, they say when your mind goes, they say, gently bring yourself back to your breath, right? And the word gentle in Hawaiian, I come from a Hawaiian culture, the word is olu, O-L-U-O-L-U. And a Hawaiian elder said, olu doesn't necessarily mean gentle. It means to treat like a baby. And
wow.
I think there's something very powerful there, that when you're going through this process, when you're becoming aware of those physical sensations, it's important to have that kindfulness to treat like a baby. And I think of, you know, this woman and her boyfriend rubbing her belly or wherever dis-ease was, right? That's how you treat a baby, like soft touches on the skin. And Yeah, it's just beautiful. It's a beautiful story, and it's a beautiful practice I think we can all incorporate.
Absolutely. I love that word, olu, olu. I'm going to use that, treat it like a baby. I love that. It's exactly, it's spot on, I feel.
And I think for a lot of, at least for me and a lot of the people who I meditate with, we tend to be more Spartan, right? Like we do the Vipassana and then we do the Atitana where you don't move and you know, your leg hurts. You just like, I'm just going to power through this, you know? Mm. And it's so important to have that gentleness, that olu, olu, that kindfulness with your body and with your process and with your meditation. It's something that I missed in the sense of I didn't get it for so long, and for you to share that story just really hammers in that this is an essential part of mindfulness, is the kindfulness.
Yeah, exactly. And the ancient word for, I think it's sati, the ancient kind of Pali word for mindfulness, actually has the concept of heart in it, which is why I think we should refer to it as heartfulness or kindfulness. So the actual word itself always reminds us of the compassionate element, which is why I'm hoping that we start to move on from using the word mindfulness to kindfulness, because that's really, and in Eastern philosophies, the word for mind and heart are kind of, they're kind of connected together. So it's, and I think language is very, very important, whereas mindfulness is partly attractive because it's about the mind and about the brain and about logic, and it's very much that kind of Western way of thinking. But that's not what the heart of it was, actually. It's to do with this more heartful, kindful, bringing the love in together with the awareness, and that's when it becomes, then it has that transformative effect, like you said. And I'm so glad you mentioned the physical body. I mean, I discovered kindfulness when I started to be really, really friendly and kind to my body and let myself lie down when I was doing the meditations and asking my body, actually, what posture would be really olu olu for you, really treating myself like a baby. You wouldn't force a baby to sit in a certain position. You'd want it, that baby, him or her, to sit in a comfortable, cozy posture, a loving posture. And I think that helps with the meditation as well, big time.
Yeah, real quick, because we have a lot of reflections that I want to get to online. It just reminds me of when I forget his name. He does a lot of research into compassion and kindfulness and mindfulness. And when they first went to Tibet and they were studying compassion, they put those brain scanner things on the heads of the monks. And the monks,
Richie Davidson, I think.
Richie Davidson, exactly. Thank you, Shamash. And the monks just all laughed at them, you know, and they said, why are you putting this on our heads? Like, if you want to study compassion, if you want to, it's in the heart, right? You got your monitors in the wrong place, right? Even the highest researchers that are researching this tend to forget that.
Yeah, exactly. That would be a good poster for the West. We've got the monitors in the wrong place.
Exactly. So we have a reflection online from Mish, and she says, mindfulness helps me to be more present to what is going on in and around me. I become more aware of my emotions and can better short-circuit my reactiveness, which enables more equanimity when feeling overwhelmed by something. More the quote-unquote observer, which helps me to find balance. And I think, being overwhelmed by something and being able to short-circuit that reactiveness. I don't know, maybe you can talk about that, Shamash. When you have that reactiveness, like you said, how your friend she gets so pissed off at the people smoking at the non-smoking sign, right? You have that reactiveness and how mindfulness can help, Mish says, short-circuit that reactiveness.
Yeah. Well, congratulations to her. She's done really, really well with that practice. It just reminds me of a quote that I suppose some of you have heard many times before by Viktor Frankl about between stimulus and response, there's a space. And it's about just to kind of I can't remember it exactly, but it's about finding that space and being more conscious in that space, and that's where we have our choice. And so I suppose mindfulness helps us do that. It's very much about living, like I described, that very automatic life where I had this kind of type of circuitry in my brain about the way life should be, and living my life that way in a very automatic way and reacting to people, where you're not really living, are you? If you're not consciously aware, and it's almost like a program running through your brain about waking up and treating people in certain ways, you're almost not alive. It's almost a non-living thing, non-living being. And then when you start to become conscious, like Nisha is, and becoming more aware of your emotions, and then short-circuiting them, like she describes, so that you're creating that space and you start to expand that space more and more. And I would argue also using the sense of kindness and compassion and love to help to heal those challenging emotions that come up, and gentleness towards ourselves so that they soften and soothe and pass, then that can actually change the whole world. Because of all of our reactivity and the lack of wisdom and lack of making conscious decisions is based on that. So that's why I think this quote comes up so much about be the change we want to see in the world, become more aware of ourselves, self-awareness, self-compassion, so that we can make these more conscious and wise choices. So that's a beautiful example of really going back to the very root of the cause of violence and suffering for ourselves and others. And so what a beautiful example of doing that. So thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, and that's a beautiful, I love the Viktor Frankl quote of opening up that space, right? That and mindfulness helps us open up that space. And it reminds me of, you know, when you say like before, and I've been this way too, you have this knee-jerk reactiveness. This is the way things should be. You should not be smoking next to a non-smoking sign. Right? this should be kind of mentality. And when you open up that space, it reminds me of Byron Katie. I don't know if you know who Byron Katie is, but she's like a spiritual worker. And she just asks people, is that true? Can you be 100% certain that that's true, right? And when you open up that space, you realize, that's not necessarily true. Like, if you shouldn't be smoking next to a non-smoking sign, then how are those people doing it? They're doing it, right? So that's not necessarily true. So it's beautiful when you open up that space and short-circuit that reactivity. Or actually, short-circuit is a good word for it because it actually extinguishes it, right? When you open up that space and realize that that should is not true, then it fizzles out.
Yeah. Almost imagine like the, because we do have these pathways in our brain, don't we, about the way we think and the way we act. And I imagine like people walking through like a cornfield and it becomes easier and easier. And so the way she describes it, like a short circuit, it's like you're taking the courage to actually go on a different path, a path you haven't been down before. So it's a bit more difficult at the beginning, but you're finding a route where you don't react in an aggressive way straight away, or get depressed about that situation straight away, or get anxious about it. We actually choose not to. And it's difficult at the beginning because you've not been through that pathway. I'm not sure if it's a short circuit or a long circuit or whatever that route is, but you're finding the courage to go a different route. And that route does become easier the more we make that choice. Maybe that's what wisdom is all about, is cultivating those more conscious choices and creating a bigger space between that stimulus and response. And Viktor Frankl, I mean, he's the example of someone in the most extreme of circumstances, you know, being in a concentration camp and actually managing to do that. So that gives me motivation that I can certainly do that when I'm traveling around in London or interacting with people. If he can do it, then certainly we should be able to try and find the space to be able to do that too.
Yeah. Our next question, I think, we've answered, but I'll ask it anyway. So Amir asks, what practice have you found to work effectively for participants post-retreat sessions to maintain mindfulness momentum and not just experience temporary benefits? Actually, that's not the question so maybe you can answer that question. He has a follow-up question. How do you reach participants who are more focused on the research results when more rigorous scientific studies are still needed? So there's two questions there. One about reaching people who are research results based. And then the first one about, I think sustainability, right? Like keeping the, he calls it mindfulness momentum, so it's not just temporary.
Yeah. So in terms of, if I understand correctly, in terms of people who are very much orientated to looking at the research, yeah, there's limited, there's always, science is always evolving and there's no right or wrong answer. And, you know, at the moment, a lot of science says physical exercise is really good, but what if some study comes about that says that actually it's not that great, or maybe less is better or something? So it's a constantly evolving thing. It's not like a fixed answer that we have. So I would urge people to find out from their own experience, because of science will always say something for the general population, but each of us are different. And I think someone like the Buddha experimented on his own mind, and he found out for in his own mind and heart what was the right and the wrong thing. So he looked within. And so we can be the ultimate scientists of our own thoughts, emotions, bodily sensations, our reactions and responses to the people around us. And no science will be able to say exactly for us what is the right thing in each moment to do. So the ultimate science is to be really present to our own day-to-day, moment-to-moment experiences and to respond from that. So in terms of convincing other people to kind of get into the mindfulness and meditation, I think almost always it's the way we live our own lives, because ultimately, whether they're the biggest decision makers like CEOs or people in charge of the health of a country or someone, some other one person, ultimately they are motivated by emotions and examples and what they see. And so if you are yourself cultivating a sense of mindfulness and compassion for yourself and around you, they will notice that. And it's these small acts, which again, service space emphasizes a lot, that will actually wake them up to, oh, wow, this person's really changed. They've really transformed the way they walk, the way they behave, the way they talk. It's not inauthentic. They're not acting. This is another thing. It's not about acting spiritual or acting mindful, but really genuinely from the heart, they're being who they are. They're being themselves. Mm. They're being their personality. But they've also got this sense of presence, and they're really friendly and really kind and really loving and really caring. And I want a bit of that, and I want to share that with my organization or my community. So I think that this Be the Change approach is probably even more powerful than any scientific research as well, because ultimately decisions are made on an emotional level as well as the science. In terms of the question about retreats, I think you need to be careful not to try and hold on to that experience. So, this kind of approach, this kind of Buddhist approach, which I think works really well, it is about attachment is the cause of suffering, and letting go is the cause of happiness and well-being. So when we're on a retreat, we do our best to be on the retreat and to be present and to cultivate the compassion and the awareness. And then when the retreat is over, it's about being aware and compassionate of our surroundings, and as best you can, doing the practices that you can do. And you may not be able to do as much as you were doing on that retreat, and that's okay, because of life is not all about retreats. It's all about being present to the needs around you and the needs of yourself. And so you may not be able to match your levels of presence and compassion, and being understanding and forgiving of yourself is a good start. So that's okay. There's time for retreat, and there's also time to do work. And, you know, although you may be wanting, you may have this ideal, let's say, of wanting to do an hour a day and you're not managing to do it, it's much better for you to drop that and to just be present in your experience. I know one teacher, when they ask him, when's the best time to do meditation, how long to do it? And he says, the best time is now and the best place is here. So ultimately, we only have here and now. And so as you're listening to me right now, rather than thinking about how planning mindfulness for the future, mindfulness and kindfulness can only be cultivated in the here and now. So dropping the plans about the future and dropping the plans for I'm going to meditate at this time and do this much, but actually being really present to what's happening right now, either listening to this conversation or listening to your body, and maybe your body needs a rest. Maybe it needs to stop listening to this and actually needs to lie down for 5 or 10 minutes. That's a beautiful example of being kindful in the moment too. So I'm not into, personally anyway, into kind of planning things too much. I think in our society, we control too much and plan too much. And I think the joy of living is actually through letting that go. So going from being a control freak to being a kindness freak and living in the moment and being as kind as we can from a moment to moment basis.
Shamash. That's funny, because right when you said that about being mindful in this moment and listening to the conversation, I was looking, we have two more questions. I was looking at the time and I was like, how am I going to squeeze these in? Am I going to talk about that? I was thinking about that right when you said that.
That's all right. You can be kind. You can't just jump there. It's impossible.
I'll be kind to myself. I'm wondering if we can go a little bit over it and I can at least get one of these questions in, Shamash.
Yeah, yeah.
Adonia says, hi, thanks so much for the talk. And Shamash, I'm really enjoying this talk. I'm struggling in this economy and the concept of money, but you mentioned imagining that one goes to space and when one comes back to imagine how life can be. Can you explain a little bit about this exercise? Thank you.
Yeah, so the way we did, thank you for the question. So this particular exercise, and you could try it out. So the idea is you just spend a few minutes practicing meditation, mindfulness, or relaxation, however works for you. And then just imagining you're kind of zooming out from your life. So the idea is to take yourself out from your job and your family and your work and all the stuff that you do. And imagine going out, so out from planet Earth, right up. And then you just say to yourself, when you can't even go back to your life, you're going to go back to living your ideal life. So living in a location which is ideal for you, in line with your values, what feels right for you. The work you do is very much in line with your heart and what you love doing, and the people you interact with are the kind of people you want. And you're serving the people that are the kind of people that really works for you, and whatever your unique ability is, you're really using that. And so just kind of really visualizing when you go zoom back into this kind of ideal way of living and breathing and being, is that's what's going to happen when you go back. And then you just imagine yourself going back to planet Earth and just visualizing going back to wherever it is that you end up going, actually. So it's almost like a discovery process. And so you end up and you find yourself in a certain location, living in a certain place, and you ask yourself, what kind of home am I living in? Who are the people that I'm interacting with? Maybe even what clothes I'm wearing? What does it smell like? What does it look like? Where do I go to work? Who are the people I interact with? And it can almost be just like a fun experiment. And it may not be, you know, the right thing for you. It may not be realistic. It may not feel right. But, you know, you might get something out of it. So although it may not be possible to work in that place you want to work, maybe some of those values you want to bring into your work. So let's say you're an accountant at the moment and you visualize yourself being, I don't know, a meditation teacher somewhere in India and you're living in England and you're an accountant, then okay, you may not be able to do it straight away, but maybe you can bring some meditation to your workplace, for example. Or you may want to maybe imagine a beautiful garden, but you have no garden, you just have a flat, then maybe you can go to a local allotment, or you can start planting some plants. So you can take small steps towards that. So yeah, that's that exercise that you could try out.
Beautiful. So Shamash, we always ask a question at the end of our calls of a guest. What can we as a service-based community do to help what you're doing in the world to serve you? What kind of things can we do on those lines?
Wow, that's what a beautiful question to end with. Particularly what's on my mind most at the moment is the Museum of Happiness and helping it to become a project that is sustainable and as closely as we can in line with the service space approach and kind of thinking and goals. So in terms of how people could support that, I'm not too sure how that would actually look. We're going to try designing and doing more experiments, such as Awakened Circles and Karma Kitchen. So if anybody wants to kind of share any kind of ideas or insights about that, then they'd be very welcome to do so. And we could just send it through to our email and we can read it. If you have some ideas of projects that we could do or suggestions, or even little videos you want to share with us, or resources about how we could bring this beautiful philosophy more and more into what we're doing, then that would be really appreciated. That's all I can think of at the moment. But yeah, that would be really, really helpful. And maybe just sending some compassion and kindness to our project as we're going forward, because we're at a very kind of delicate early stage. So even sending positive vibes would be very much appreciated, and we will do the same back to the service-based community too.
Wonderful, wonderful. Rahul, did you have any final comments?
I just wanted to thank Shamash for sharing so deeply and personally from your own journey, and also the way it's intertwined with so many people that you've worked with. So I really, really appreciate the authenticity with which you've shared today.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate both of your questions. Yeah, I really felt that you'd taken time to reflect on the right questions to ask. And it's been so enjoyable. The time has gone so fast, I can't believe it.
That's what happens when you're mindful. So on that one, we're going to end with a moment of silence. And obviously, after that beautiful talk on mindfulness and kindness, I just invite everybody to take this minute to be mindful and kindful to yourself and to your body and to all that's going around. So we'll do a minute. Thank you. Thank you so much, Shamash. Thank you so much, Rahul. It was a beautiful conversation. Have a beautiful rest of your weekend.
Thank
Wonderful.
You.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.